Hello, my name is Glenn Treisman. I'm a professor and director of the AIDS Psychiatry Service at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. This is an ISUSA module on addressing substance abuse and alcohol prior to hepatitis C treatment. I want to thank you all for joining us for this presentation. In this presentation, I intend to discuss alcohol use and liver disease, recommendations for alcohol sobriety prior to treatment, drug use in liver disease, and recommendations for drug abstinence prior to treatment. I want to begin by pointing out the incredible importance of collaborative treatment in patients with substance abuse disorders and hepatitis C. In this first slide, I show a meta-analysis from Great Britain looking at the effects of opiate substitution treatment on hepatitis C incidence. And what you can see is opiate substitution programs decrease the likelihood of hepatitis C in patients, new incidence of hepatitis C, in patients in Great Britain. More importantly, from this same study, what you can show is opiate substitution by itself decreases the odds of getting hepatitis C by about two-thirds. Needle syringe exchange decreases it by half, and when you put them together, you do decrease it by four-fifths. This represents a huge improvement in hepatitis C prevention by simply using substance abuse harm reduction programs. This shows you the entanglement between hepatitis C and substance abuse and the importance of collaborative treatment. In the next slide, I show you an integrated model for alcohol use in hepatitis C in patients who are getting ready to undergo treatment. In this study, the number of patients who were sober at the initial interview was only 20%, while by intervening at 6 months, 40% of patients are sober. And lastly, in this randomized controlled trial of integrated care, patients were initially deferred from treatment because of psychiatric issues, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, and more than one. And if you look at the patients with an intervention, 42% are ready for treatment after the intervention, while it's only 18% of the patients without the intervention getting general standard of care interventions are ready. This more than doubles the percentage of patients ready for treatment with a fairly simple integrated care intervention to try to improve their eligibility for treatment of hepatitis C. Again, all of these studies emphasize the importance of collaborative treatment in patients with hepatitis C. In the next slide, I review the facts that patients with alcohol use who have hepatitis C are more likely to have intrinsic liver disease, cirrhosis, and mortality, and decreases the likelihood of their getting treatment. Patients who are currently drinking are less likely to get treatment and less likely to succeed in treatment. In the next slide, I point out that historical alcohol abuse does not change outcome. That is, patients who were previously drinkers but have now become sober do quite well. However, recent alcohol use reduces the likelihood of getting treatment and the likelihood of completing treatment. In people who complete treatment, recent alcohol use does not appear to change the likelihood of a sustained viral response. It more likely seems to cause people to not complete treatment. I want to spend a few minutes talking about addictions versus use of drugs. The term addiction has been a confounder for many people over the years, and it was kicked out of the DSM for many years. The term addiction was kicked out of the DSM for many years. And things like abuse and dependence were substituted for the term addiction. In part, that's because it's much more easy to categorize abuse and categorize dependence than it is to categorize addiction. So when thinking about addiction, what do we really mean? My current definition of addiction is continued increasing stereotyped use of a behavior that, despite mounting consequences that disrupt all functions of life, continues. That is, the patient continues to do more and more of whatever it is they're doing, despite increasing consequences and mounting losses. In the next slide, I show some of the things that make a drug addictive, and the most important features seem to be tolerance, dependence, and reinforcement. Tolerance is an increasing dose required to achieve the desired effect. Physical dependence is when it's a withdrawal syndrome that occurs when the drug is taken away. And reinforcement is a behavioral term that means that the person's behavior that they were doing right before they used increases after drug exposure. That is, whatever you were doing before you used the drug increases after using the drug. Many of you in the audience would say you're addicted to caffeine, and some of you would say you're addicted to smoking. While both nicotine and caffeine can cause addiction, in most people, they simply cause dependence. Very few people are disordered by their use of caffeine, and very few people are disordered by the use of nicotine until the life medical consequences of nicotine come along. Few people will get involved in dangerous sexual behaviors because of coffee, and few people will rob stores or commit serious crimes to get cigarettes. While we consider both of these substances addictive, they're really dependence-producing and produce less of the addictive behaviors than we see with illicit drugs and with prescribed opiates. In the next slide, I have a diagram of the ascending mesolimbic dopamine pathway, courtesy of Elliot Gardner. The red circle at the base of this rat's brain projects to an area in the middle of the brain called the nucleus accumbens. The release of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens is the core feature of all addictive drugs. While they produce this by different mechanisms, all addictive drugs produce a release of dopamine, the main brain reward transmitter, in the part of the brain that is involved in perceiving rewards. Drugs like amphetamine, cocaine, opiates, cannabinoids, phencyclidine, ketamine, alcohol, barbiturates, and benzodiazepines all appear to work through this pathway. In the next slide, I have pointed out some of the more common addictive drugs, including psychomotor stimulants that work by dopamine, amphetamine, cocaine, and others, opiates, sedative hypnotics, and alcohol, which all work through the GABA receptor, cannabinoids, phencyclidine, and ketamine, which seem to work through the NMDA receptor. And then I have hallucinogens and nicotine and caffeine at the bottom of the slide, which do activate this pathway, but to a lesser extent, and seem to produce less disrupted behavior. In the next slide, I review the disease model of addiction. We commonly call addiction a disease, which is useful because it removes blame and stigma for patients and emphasizes medical treatment. The problem with referring to addiction as a disease is that behavioral models are better than lesion models, and the idea of a disease removes responsibility from patients and doesn't account for the volitional component present in addictions. Psychiatric diseases like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression represent broken parts in the brain, and if you offered patients a cure for any of those conditions, they would eagerly accept it. If you told a patient with alcohol addiction that you were going to give them a drug that would make it so they never had any interest in alcohol again, wouldn't want to use it, even if it was present, but could use it and wouldn't get anything out of it, most of them would say, "Wait a minute, I'm not sure I'm ready for that." I find the behavioral model of addiction much more useful, which I summarize in the next few slides. This first slide is the law of effect from Thorndike in 1913 and refers to learning. In general, we have an opportunity to do a behavior from the environment. We do the behavior, and then the environment responds either positively, in which case we increase the rate of behavior, or negatively, in which case we decrease it. So if I wear a particular tie and everybody says you look stupid in that tie, I'm less likely to wear it again. If everybody says you look great in that tie, I'm more likely to wear it again. This is learning 101. We all learn this way. For certain behaviors, however, there's a more complex pathway. For behaviors that are involved in addiction, there's an environmental exposure, a behavior, and then besides the environmental response, a brain response of reinforcement. These include behaviors of eating, sleeping, and sex. The behavior might include something like a baby crying, and then the baby's fed, and this causes reward and reinforcement, and the baby is satisfied, and the baby gets hungry and he cries again. And this cycle is an amplification loop. It increases the likelihood of crying and the likelihood of eating. Over time, this cycle is shaped by the environment. Instead of crying, babies have to ask for things, say mama, use silverware, sit at the table, have manners, and eventually buy and prepare food. This cycle is amplifying. That is, the more you do it, the more you want it, the more you want it, the more you do it. One of the dangers of that cycle is it can get out of control. There is a turnoff for eating, sleeping, and sex, which I have at the bottom of this cycle, where I have satiation. After Thanksgiving dinner, no one wants to eat anymore. You're satisfied, and the cycle is off. If the off circuit isn't quite perfect, then people have a tendency to overeat, which can lead to obesity and chubbiness, a very dangerous element of these kinds of amplification cycles. Syndromes of excess eating, sleeping, and sex are all problematic for patients and represent dysregulations of this cycle. Addictive drugs work directly at the reward and reinforcement pathway of this cycle. But unfortunately, as we were evolving, there was no turnoff for drugs, and so that cycle can get out of control fairly easily. The purpose of this amplification loop is to prevent the actual accidental extinguishing of behaviors, such as eating, by something like food poisoning. If you're food poisoned, you're less likely to eat again. But after a period of time, you get hungry, and this cycle drives you to eat again, even though you may have had a very aversive experience. That's why this cycle only occurs in behaviors necessary for survival. In the next slide, I've showed you the influences of temperament, personality, life experience, and disease on both the likelihood of doing a behavior and the likelihood it will be reinforcing. For instance, depressed patients don't receive much reinforcement for the normal activities like eating, sleeping, and sex, and therefore drugs that stimulate dopamine release, like cocaine, are particularly addictive in patients who have major depression. Patients who are around drugs a lot or who have extroverted temperaments are more likely to try drugs and more likely to value the reinforcement that they produce. And in this next slide, I have the role of genes, social connections, religion, occupation, class, social conventions, and geography on this cycle. That is, people with risk-taking genes are more likely to try a behavior. People with genes for reinforcement by alcohol are more likely to become alcoholics. People with lots of social connections, occupation, and social conventions that put brakes on this cycle are less likely to get addicted, and patients with these things extinguished in their lives because of dislocations are more likely to get addicted. The reason we aren't all addicted is because the cycle of addiction interferes or competes with the cycles for eating, sleeping, and sex, work, hobbies, or exercise, and other things that are going on in our lives. When you think about this cycle, it leads, obviously, to the next few slides I have on treatment. The core elements of addiction treatment include conversion, that is, the patient admitting they're an alcoholic or a drug addict, detoxification, removal of the drug from the environment and from the person, and then rehabilitation to reestablish social conventions, cycles of work, hobbies, and exercise, eating, sleeping, and sex, and try to prevent the reestablishment of the addictive cycle. I have group therapy here as one of the key ingredients. Rehabilitation occurs most effectively with the addition of group therapy. 12-step programs or other forms of group are essential to treatment of behaviors, particularly substance abuse. Then I have treatment of psychiatric comorbid conditions, including depression, personality, and other things. And lastly, relapse prevention. Conversion is the step in which you get the patient to accept the fact that they need treatment. All of you are good at doing this in various ways. I tend to be confrontive with a smile. People talk about motivational interviewing, which they help patients prepare for change. But ultimately, it involves discussing the difference between your goals and what might be the patient's goals. My goals for patients include quality of life, longevity, and function, and comfort is much lower down the list than it is for my patients. Often, talking about this helps people to prepare for the conversion that they need to have to develop the treatment contract. When I talk about treatment contracts here, I'm not talking about a written piece of paper and a pencil. I'm talking about the discussion that you have with the patient between what your job is and what their job is. Detoxification, shown in the next slide, includes stopping the behavior, preventing withdrawal, diminishing craving, and treating accompanying problems that go along with detoxification. Till you get the person to stop using the drug, you can't treat the condition. Rehabilitation is a more complicated thing, but essentially involves damage control, environmental change, and prescribing new habits and programs for the patient to replace the drug addiction that had taken over their life. The treatment of comorbid conditions, particularly major depression, involves thinking about patients with mood disorders. Even though they're depressed from drug use, they may also have major depression, and treatment of major depression improves outcome considerably, but also attention to their life story and problems and management of their temperament with coaching interventions. We often recommend substituted addiction like methadone and buprenorphine, which will help patients to get off of drugs and reestablish these things. And again, it's important to note that collaborative treatment in which patients are treated for hepatitis C, other infections, addictions, and psychiatric disorders in one setting dramatically improves overall outcome. While not all of you are going to become addiction treatment experts, all of you need to participate in helping your patients move from the state where they are to the state where they need to be, which is in accepting the need for treatment of more than their hepatitis C if they're addicted to drugs or alcohol, and the acceptance that a sober lifestyle is necessary for them to survive. In summary, success for hepatitis C treatment is dependent on treatment of depression and addiction. Alcohol often leads to failed treatment, increases morbidity and mortality. Integrated treatment is effective and improves outcome, and addiction expertise is a necessary ingredient for the successful treatment of hepatitis C. You don't have to become an expert at treatment of addiction, but you do have to have addiction expertise available to supplement your patient's treatment if you want to stop the epidemic of hepatitis C that currently faces all of us.